and let KBOO disappear? Or are you going to fight back? 877-500-5266. It has to be you. It has to be now. 877-500-5266. Going out to you via 90.7 FM and other frequencies in Cascadia and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
Citizens gather in celebration of Jedi, rebels, and the power of the Force. They wear costumes, have parties, and share greetings and pictures on their social networks. They say it's fun, but what aren't they telling you about May the 4th? They say that the rebels are heroes, looking to restore freedom to the galaxy. Fact, the Jedi and rebels are traitors to the Empire, and so are all those who celebrate May the 4th.
No, no, no. Tune in Thursday night, right before midnight, for a very special Star Wars celebration. May the 4th be with you.
May the 4th is a dangerous and immoral holiday. This year, say yes to the Empire. Say no to Jedi. Say no to Rebels. And say no to May the 4th. Paid for by the Emperor's Committee to Destroy May the 4th.
Good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fogering, and today we have a special guest, Stephen Gowans, who is the author of a book called Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, The Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. And this book is one of our thank you premiums. It's available for, I believe, a $60 pledge. I think we have three copies. So it's an excellent book, Patriots, Traitors, and Empires by Stephen Gowans. And we're trying to get him on. We have him on the air right now. So, Stephen, good morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Gowans, is that how you pronounce the last name?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, we're sort of in the middle of, this is the last day of our membership drive. So we're gonna go on for 25 minutes, and then the last 5 minutes we'll be asking for money to keep this kind of programming on the air. So why don't we just jump right into the book? Who are the patriots and who are the traitors?
Well, that's a great question to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
The patriots are these are Korean patriots. So the patriots are people who fought to drive the Japanese occupation out of their country. The Japanese colonized Korea starting in 1905. In 1905, they established a protectorate. In 1910, they formally incorporated Korea into their empire. And there were Koreans, many, hundreds of thousands of Koreans, actually, who fought against Japanese colonialism, who fought against the empire and tried to drive the military occupation off the Korean Peninsula. And that, then, is what patriots refers to, the Koreans who tried to emancipate their country from the domination of the Japanese. Traitors refers to those Koreans who collaborated with the Japanese, the Quislings or hirelings, many of whom joined the Japanese Imperial Army, went to officer school and became officers in the Japanese Imperial Army, and fought against their compatriots who were opposed to the Japanese colonial domination of their country. Some of those traitors, in fact, became, well, they became or held significant positions in the South Korean state, and one of them became a long-serving president of South Korea.
Well, actually, one of the patriot leaders was Kim Il-sung. Tell us about him.
Yes, Kim Il-sung was a very important patriot leader. Kim Il-sung is the grandfather of the current leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. Kim Il-sung established a guerrilla band in 1932, and he established that band with the intention of driving the Japanese ultimately out of Korea. But he had, or his family had decided to flee Korea during the colonial period, and they went to Manchuria, which abuts Korea, and that's where they lived. And then the Japanese also invaded Manchuria and established a puppet state in Manchuria. And it's at that point that Kim had come of age and decided that he would take up arms against the Japanese, first to drive them out of Manchuria and ultimately to drive them out of his homeland, Korea. Kim had considerable charisma, highly developed organizational skills, and an unquestioned commitment to Korean sovereignty. This was recognized by his fellow Japanese resistance leaders. And when the Japanese Empire fell in 1945 and the resistance leaders came from Manchuria back to Korea, those anti-Japanese resistance leaders decided that they would promote him as the maximal leader. And certainly the Japanese regarded him as a very formidable opponent. At one point, they established an anti-Kim unit and undertook a campaign to hunt him down.
Well, one interesting thing is that the U.S. Made a deal with Japan, sort of dividing up empires, that Japan was allowed to take over Korea, and in return, the U.S. was allowed to sort of have a free hand in the Philippines. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, and this is quite interesting. One of the things that some people might find difficult to understand is that Koreans, en masse, leaned toward communism and were inspired by the Bolsheviks and rejected the United States. And now some people might have difficulty understanding that. And one way to explain it is this way. I mean, the Koreans were colonized people. They're downtrodden. They're enslaved by the Japanese. And the Bolshevik Revolution becomes a model for them because they look to the Bolsheviks and they see, well, here are some downtrodden people just like us who, through their own efforts, have emancipated themselves. So they become a model for the Koreans on how to emancipate themselves from Japanese colonialism. At the same time, the Bolsheviks are encouraging the colonial peoples of the world, including the Koreans, to shake off the chains of tyranny. And they're providing what material assistance they can. Then they look to the United States. And the United States itself is a colonial power. I mean, the United States had colonized Hawaii and Guam and the Philippines, and we have the Monroe Doctrine. And you can even argue that the United States is an empire if you consider that it began as 13 colonies on the Atlantic coast and became a vast continental empire by essentially absorbing the land that belonged to other people, i.e. the Aboriginal people or Mexicans, for example. So the Koreans look to the United States as essentially another colonial power, a power that's involved in the colonial racket, which also makes a deal with the Japanese, as you said. And the deal is, look, if you recognize our colonial claim to the Philippines, we'll recognize your claim to Korea. And at one point, high U.S. officials say, actually, we think it's a good thing that the Japanese have absorbed Korea into their empire. This infuriates the Koreans. And then we have that attitude contrasted with the attitude that comes from Moscow of, you Korean people ought to overthrow or shake off the chains of this Japanese tyranny. And that's why Koreans en masse, not just Koreans in the North, but Koreans in the North and South, were inspired by communism. And the United States, at the end of the Second World War, was very concerned that if Korea was left to its own devices and left alone, it would become a communist country. Many U.S. historians today acknowledge that were it not for the intervention of the United States, Korea would have become communist, as China was about to become communist, and as U.S. planners feared that Japan would become communist as well in the wake of the Second World War.
Well, they felt the same way about countries in Europe, too.
Yes, exactly.
Similar situation, where the resistance to the Nazi occupation was very strong among the communists of France and Italy.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
And they were very, very likely to take in power in free elections after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are talking with Stephen Gowans, author of Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, The Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. And this book is available for, I believe, a $60 minimum pledge. And the number to call for that is 877-500-5266. So after the World War II ended, the Japanese were defeated. Then somehow Korea was divided, and in the southern portion, a fellow named Syngman Rhee was put in power.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Japanese surrender, and the United States drew a line across the 38th parallel, dividing Korea into a northern, or into the north and south, essentially dividing Korea into U.S. and Soviet occupation zones. And the understanding was that these occupation zones would last no longer than 5 years. So before the five-year period had elapsed, both occupying armies, the Soviet and the U.S. armies, would withdraw, and there would be elections for a national government. The Soviets were in the northern part of Korea first. The Soviet Union had an agreement with the United States and Britain, their allies in the Second World War, that 90 days after the end of the war in Europe, they would enter the war in the Pacific. They would declare war on Japan, which they did. And as soon as they declared war in Japan, they immediately moved into Manchuria and then into Korea, and they occupied their zone, which was north of the 38th parallel. In the meantime, nothing was happening in the U.S. zone because the U.S. Army had not yet arrived. In fact, U.S. forces didn't arrive on the peninsula for about a month after the Japanese surrender. So an interesting question to ask is what was going on during that month as, before the U.S. forces arrived on the peninsula. And what was going on is because the Japanese had surrendered, there is now a power vacuum, and someone had to administer the country. Someone had to govern it. So Koreans in both the North and the South established committees to organize their civil affairs, to provide government. And in the North, where the Soviets were present, the Soviets allowed the Koreans to organize their affairs and to prepare government that would take over once the Soviet and U.S. forces withdrew. In the south, without U.S. forces there yet, the Koreans went about organizing their affairs, establishing a government. And 2 days before the American forces arrived on the peninsula, the Koreans got together. They brought all their committees together and formed a national government, and they declared a republic. They called it the Korean People's Republic. This would be the first indigenously organized, independent Korean government in 40 years. 2 days later, the U.S. forces arrived. The new government sent a delegation to greet the U.S. forces. The U.S. forces refused to recognize the delegation and refused to recognize the new Korean People's Republic. And they refused to recognize it because the United States had developed, at the beginning of the war, the intention to exercise influence in East Asia. They looked at the war as an opportunity to expand their influence throughout the world. And they saw Korea as an opportunity to expand U.S. Power. And so the United States had no intention of allowing the Koreans to establish an independent government in Korea. They immediately set about trying to crush this new Korean People's Republic, or the committees that had were organizing within the U.S. occupation zone. And they did. They undertook essentially an anti-insurgency war because Korean patriots committed to Korean sovereignty decided they were going to fight the U.S. occupation. If the United States was not going to recognize their sovereignty, well, they would take up arms and drive the U.S. off the peninsula in the same way they had taken up arms to drive the Japanese off the peninsula. Well, so the United States organized an anti-insurgency campaign to crush these guerrillas who are fighting for Korean independence within the U.S. occupation zone. Meanwhile, the Soviets were allowing this new government, this new indigenously organized government, to flourish in their zone. So we had two very different approaches to the, you know, this indigenously organized government. Ultimately, the United States recognized that if there were free elections on the peninsula, as had been planned, that Kim Il-sung, this man who of enormous charisma, who was regarded as a patriot, that and was a communist, and because Koreans lean toward communism, that he would win the election. So deciding that that was not a possibility they were willing to tolerate, the United States essentially organized the political division of the peninsula by, as you say, installing a man named Syngman Rhee within their occupation zone as president of a new republic, which they called the Republic of Korea.
This sort of is very, very much similar to what later happened in Vietnam, but go ahead.
Yes, exactly. It exactly anticipates what happened in Vietnam. And it was only after the United States organized the division or the creation of the Republic of Korea, which most Koreans opposed vehemently because they didn't want their country divided. Why would they want their country divided? They recognized that there was going to be a political division and incessant tension and conflict within the country if that happened. So they were opposed, but they went ahead, established the Republic of Korea. And it was only after that was established that the North Korean state was established. And the North Korean state was known as the, or is known as the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which one can argue is essentially the successor to the short-lived Korean People's Republic, which the United States set out to crush.
So what one thing Syngman Rhee did was he pushed through this national security law, and I believe that is still in effect. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. The national security law is essentially an anti-communist, anti-North Korea law, and it is the foundation of the police state of South Korea. Now, people in the West don't usually recognize South Korea as a police state. They think of North Korea as a police state, but not South Korea as a police state. But South Korea was established as a police state, and it had to be a police state. If you think about this, if most Koreans lean toward communism and you imposed upon them essentially a U.S. puppet state, which was going to be anti-communist, and it was vehemently anti-communist, that meant that the state was going to be at war with its population, so it had to be a police state. And the basis of the police state was the national security law, which is still on the books, which is essentially punishes anyone who has anything good to say about the North Koreans. So many Koreans in the South were arrested under the national security law and imprisoned for expressing political views which were considered intolerable to the South Korean state, i.e. any kind of leftist political views, anything that hinted of leftism, anything that hinted of sympathy to North Korea, any of that. If one expressed any of those views, one was vulnerable or liable to be arrested under the national security law.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Per Fogring, Fight the Empire. My guest is Stephen Gowans, the author of Patriots, Traitors, and Empires. And this book is available for a $60 minimum pledge. So call 877-500-5266. Why don't we skip ahead? There's so much material in here, but I'd like to get ahead a little bit. Now, Syngman Rhee was succeeded by Park Chung-hee, who actually had been an officer in the Japanese Army, and he was actually one of the people who were trying to hunt down Kim Il-sung.
Yeah, one of the traitors. Mm-hmm. So he had been in the Japanese Imperial Army, as you say. He'd also received a gold watch from Emperor Hirohito for services to the empire. And part of those services may have been hunting down Korean patriots who were trying to drive the Japanese out of Manchuria and out of Korea. Mm-hmm. He, along with a number of other Koreans who had served in the Japanese Imperial Army, and by the way, during the period of Japanese colonialism, had taken on Japanese names as well, including Park Chung-hee, who had taken on a Japanese name. Many of these people were the top commanders in the South Korean military, the U.S.-organized South Korean military. So in 1950, when the Korean War began, almost invariably, the top commanders on the South Korean side were veterans of the Japanese Imperial Army. The top commanders on the North Korean side were veterans of the resistance war against the Japanese occupation. One U.S. historian, Bruce Cummings, argues that the Korean War actually began in 1932, mm-hmm. not in 1950. He argues it began in 1932, mm-hmm. and Kim Il-sung established his guerrilla band to drive the Japanese out of Manchuria and Korea.
Say, I'd like to really skip ahead. There's so much material in here that we're going to have to skip over, but I can't help but ask you, right now there is presidents of North and South Korea, they held a summit and got along very well, and supposedly Kim Jong-un is going to meet with President Trump. And can you say any? Do you think that summit will happen?
Yes, I think that it'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key issues is the issue of the presence of U.S. troops on the peninsula. the United States has had an unbroken military presence on the Korean Peninsula since 1945. Today, there are somewhere between 27 and 32,000 U.S. troops stationed in South Korea, and they are under the operational control of, there are that many troops in South Korea, mm-hmm. or U.S. troops in South Korea. The South Korean army is very big. And interestingly, the South Korean army is under the formal operational control of the U.S. general.
And that is a big issue. I'm really sorry we're going to have to end this now because we are in the middle of our membership drive. But this is fascinating material, and I want to maybe talk about this some more in a future show. But we've been talking with Stephen Gowans, the author of Patriots, Traitors, and Empires. He really goes into a lot of history of Korea that most people are not aware of. And we will keep our eyes focused on this because the issue is all of a sudden it's very much in the news again. So, Stephen Gowans, thank you very much for being with us.
And thank you for having me.
Well, I wish we can do this some more later. I wish we had more time, but right now we don't. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Stephen Gowans, author of Patriots, Traitors, and Empires. Now can I talk with folks out there in Membership Central?
Oh, hi, Pear. This is Ken. I'm here with my friend John, and it's the last day of our KVU Spring membership drive. Fascinating conversation. We tend to demonize North Korea, certainly, and Stephen Gowans in his book and in your interview with him, Pear, went into kind of how the U.S. played a part in that, collaborated, and what the current conditions are like in North Korea. That book, by the way, we did have as a membership gift, but I think it's gone. Patriot, Traitors, and Empires, The Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. But if you call 877-500-5266, we have, John, another Stephen Gowan book that might be of interest, too, to our listeners.
And this is also very timely. This is called Washington's Long War on Syria. And in this book, Stephen Gowans examines the decades-long struggle between secular Arab nationalism, political Islam, and the United States imperialism for control of Syria, the self-proclaimed Den of Arabism, the last secular pan-Arabist state in the region. And so, very timely book by the same author that you just heard regarding Patriots, Traitors, and Empires. The book is called Washington's Long War on Syria. One copy for a $60 donation, $5 a month, and you can get that. That phone number to call is 877-500-5266, 877-500-KBOO. And if we're not being hacked at the very second, you can also go online and donate at KBOO.FM. Lots of drama regarding that as well.
Oh, that's true.
We are a scrappy bunch, right, Ken?
We are a scrappy bunch. As John mentioned, our website was hacked over the past few days. It was a denial of service attack, and we're not quite sure who was the attackers. Could have been some mischievous computer kids. It could have been politically motivated. It's all speculation. But for that reason, we're falling a bit short of our goal, actually a lot short of our goal. Normally, we get a lot of donations online at KBOO.FM. So there's a real sense of urgency today, the last day of our spring membership drive, to give us a call at 877-500-5266. Talk to our volunteers here. They can guide you through the process. John mentioned the book on Syria from Stephen Gowans. That's for $60 a year, but you can become a sustaining member for $5 a month. Come out of your checking account through EFT, electronic fund transfers, a credit card, a debit card, whatever is most convenient for you, we can work with, and our volunteers can guide you through the process at 877-500-5266. Plus, John, everybody who becomes a member today is entered in this drawing.
And the drawing is to, today's drawing is for 10 tickets to the Northwest Film Center and $25 to Tender Loving Empire. We were wondering what Tender Loving Empire was.
Yes, a handmade goods. I looked it up. So it's a little bit of everything. It's apparel. It's health and beauty products. They even have their own music label there. So that $25, I think, will be easy to spend.
877-500-5266 is the number to call. We better jangle these cowbells because we have some friends who've donated. This is the little cowbell. Diana of Damascus. I don't think that's Syria, but could be. But Diana has renewed. Also, Marina of Salem has renewed. And so you join these wonderful folks, Diana and Marina, by calling 877-500-5266 and get that book for $60. The book is called Washington's Long War on Syria by Stephen Gowans.
Or online, as we said, if our website's working, and it was the last time I checked this morning, at kboo.fm.
Let me just say one little thing here. If KBOO was not having an effect on the public at large, maybe this hacking would not have happened. It's a sign of our increasing visibility in the public arena. So that's all I have to say about that right now. Thank you very much for listening and for contributing. And stay tuned. There's always something good on KBOO. It's your radio station, and this is how you keep it your radio station.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Time is 10 o'clock. Up next, we have Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, Ken Jones talks to author Curtis White about his long-awaited return to fiction with his new book, Lacking Character. At 11:30, Black Book Talk welcomes poet Kwame Alexander and his guitarist, Randy Peterson, for an in-studio performance. Make history and support KBOO. If you'd like to become a member on the last day of our spring membership drive, call 877-500-KBOO.
Special thanks to our local community partners who have donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Grand Central Bakery, located at 2230 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. Grand Central Bakery is